You're listening to the For the Good of the Public podcast, an initiative of the Center for Christianity and Public Life. We're your hosts. I'm Michael Ware, founder and CEO.
And I'm Phoebe Meyer, Chief of Staff and Senior Advisor. The conversation that you all are about to hear is between Michael and Gary Haugen. And Gary is the CEO and founder of the International Justice Mission. I'm wondering, Michael, could you talk a little bit about why you wanted to sit down with Gary and have a conversation on justice and character?
Yeah, Phoebe, I thought this was a good place to sort of start as we hear from different conversations at the summit. I think I even mentioned in the interview with Gary that when we were thinking up the idea of doing the summit, this conversation with Gary is sort of the ideal conversation that we thought of. Gary is someone who has operated at such a high level, whose life has been so oriented around the public good and serving those who are what Howard Thurman referred to as the disinherited. And he's done this in a way that is not just integrated with, but supported by his faith. And so I was just thrilled to be able to have this conversation with Gary. I think that near the end of the conversation, I'm able to ask him about what he views as the future of the justice movement. And his answer is one that has stuck with me.
Michael, Gary was also pretty fundamental in the start of CCPL, but in a way that might be a little unexpected. Would you share that story?
Yeah, sure. So, gosh, now, well over a decade ago now, when I first started at the White House, my very first external meeting was with Gary Haugen. And we'd never met before. I knew of him and his work and just had a wonderful meeting. I'd grow to respect him all the more in the years that would follow. But following that meeting, Gary sent to my office a copy of this book, The Divine Conspiracy. And I'd never heard of the book. I'd never heard of the author, Dallas Willard, before. I honestly, this is a bit of an exaggeration, but kind of like took it as I was bewildered that he'd send this dense 300-page philosophical book while I was working 14, 16 right. hours a day. You know, right. I'm like, he's building a nonprofit. Like, who has time for this, I thought. And I ended up reading that book months after he sent it. And as you know, Phoebe, it changed my life. And Dallas Willard would go on to be a major influence in my life. The book, The Spirit of Our Politics, is an application of Dallas's ideas to our politics and public life. Dallas, so many of his ideas are informed the Center for Christianity and Public Life and how we think about our work. And so that's you're absolutely right, Phoebe. That's another reason why it felt so appropriate to have this conversation with Gary at our inaugural summit.
We are very thankful for Gary.
Yes, indeed.
Both for this conversation, the talk you're about to hear, and also for changing Michael's life and leading to the start of the center. The talk you all are about to hear in this episode was recorded at the For the Good of the Public Summit in Washington, D.C., and you can find a link to the recorded video in the podcast notes.
When we first had the idea for this event, who would we have speak at this? What would the conversation be? And the conversation in my mind was this one, and it was you. And so first, I just want to start by saying thank you for your leadership and what an example you are. I want to talk to you about the work of IJM, the technical expertise and credibility of it, the amazing impact you've had. I also want to talk about sort of the heart of
IJM and your heart and what the two have to do with one another and what it might suggest if the technical and the heart require one another. And so where I'd love to start is just, you know, what, Gary, what insight, what set of experiences led you to found IJM? How do you take that step?
Well, good afternoon, Michael. Good afternoon, everybody. This is delightful. Thanks for inviting me, and thanks for convening all of us for this conversation today and just for this movement that you're building. It's really encouraging and badly needed. So thank you, Michael. I think the experiences that led in many ways to starting IJM was experiences with the reality of the sin of violence in the world. I was a young college student. I was an earnest Christian. And I sensed that there was something about God I just would not know as long as I was very far from human suffering. Mm. So that's the first thing. And because my trajectory was not headed towards a lot of suffering. Suffering comes to all of us, but I just had this very charmed course. But I was also a very earnest follower of Jesus. And so in some respects, I just began to try to follow him to draw close to those who are hurting in our world. And in that process, got close to those who are hurting because of this thing called violence. More powerful people just using force to hurt you, to extract from you, to oppress you, to abuse you. And that led me, first of all, to South Africa. The mid-80s was the apartheid crisis in South Africa, and I went to go be an intern with church leaders in South Africa who were trying to bring change, and ended up being an intern for Bishop Tutu and other church leaders and in a transformative 1985 and 1986. And specifically the problem of violence against the poor. So Black South Africans were very impoverished, living very difficult economic lives, but it was because of this oppressive racist regime. Later on, I ended up working for the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights in the Philippines to see the violence of the Marcos regime in the Philippines. Eventually then went to work for the Department of Justice, working on police abuse in the United States, and this was in the 90s. I joined the Department of Justice just a few months before the Rodney King riots in L.A. and was on the Police Misconduct Task Force of the Department of Justice, where we're seeing the same phenomenon, violence against the poor. And then in 1994, I was sent to Rwanda to be the director of the UN's genocide investigation, where again, common Rwandans and the Tutsi minority in particular are very poor economically and actually getting a lot of economic aid and assistance. But when the guys with machetes show up, like none of that really matters too much. So sorry, this is a little bit long, but it's the whole thing of the problem of violence against the poor. And it became manifest to me that this was an area very unfamiliar to Christians. Familiar with, wonderfully, being in very, very poor communities and planting churches and sharing the gospel, dealing with hunger and disease and lack of shelter and so on and so forth. But again, when the guy with machetes show up, when the slave traffickers show up, and the murderers and the criminals in your community to steal your land, to commit sexual assault, to enslave your family. There was not in that era that I could find like a Christian response to that. Like, how do we even respond to that? And that's what led me to leave my job at the Department of Justice on a foolish Friday in April 1997 and become employee number one of an organization that didn't yet actually exist. So... yeah.
Right. It's one thing to identify the problem. It's another thing to build an institution that actually does something about it. Can you unpack, give folks a window in a bit to what IJM's work looks like today? What is it that you and the people who work with you actually do?
Yeah, thanks for the chance to do that. Well, it was so unglamorous and so probably going to fail when it got started. Because you can imagine, I actually go to the Department of Justice, not to resign, but to ask for a leave of absence. Because I know it's going to fail like in the first year, so I'd like to still have a job to come back to. But the first idea was super simple, and that was really IJM 1.0 was just provide direct service to victims of violence and abuse in very poor communities in the developing world. And so over time, we built little teams in very poor communities in Africa, Asia, Latin America, Southeast Asia, South Asia, local criminal investigators, lawyers, and social workers who would take on individual cases. You've been thrown into prison because they want to extract a bribe for you, or you and your family are being held in a rock quarry as a slave, or your daughter's been abducted into a brothel where she's being horrifically raped and abused, and you'd just like someone to do for you what the rest of us would want, get you out of that situation, have accountability for the guys who committed the abuse, and some long-term recovery and aftercare. So we just took cases like that. So IJM for the first 10 years had little local indigenous teams that would just take on maybe 5 cases in the first year and 12 the next. And by the end of the first decade, about, 1,000 a year. IJM 2.0 was to see if we could do maybe 3,000 or 4,000 cases a year, grow those teams, and then experiment with, why is there so much violence against the poor in these communities? It's because no one gets in trouble for doing it. That's because there's no actual law enforcement and no services for survivors. So could you transform those justice systems so they actually perform that basic service? So IJM 2.0, the second decade, was experimenting with that. And so in 9 different experiments, we found that if you could transform that justice system in that community, you could reduce violence and slavery by between 50 and 85%, as documented by external evaluators. So that was like discovery IJM 2.0. Now we're trying to do this in 46 more jurisdictions around the world that have super high rates of poverty, super high rates of violence and slavery. And we think by the year 2030, it's possible to reduce violence and slavery in these communities by between 50 and 85%. And there's 500 million people living in these 46 jurisdictions. So that's what we're doing. And there's about 1,500 IJM staff around the world. Just picture, again, teams of 30, 40, 75 criminal investigators, lawyers, social workers, advocates who are trying to get the laws actually enforced for the poorest in their community and great services for survivors in their communities.
In my new book, The Spirit of Our Politics, Spiritual Formation and the Renovation of Public Life, I share concepts that will help you understand the state of our politics, like political therapeutic deism, political hobbyism, political sectarianism. But most importantly, I offer a vision and resources for how politics can be resourced by Christian faith rather than supplanted by it. You can go to ccpubliclife.org/book to learn more about the spirit of our politics and to pick up your own copy. Thanks for reading.
You've seen in your work, both with IJM and then as you sort of laid out for us and all the experiences that led up to your founding IJM, you've seen the heart of injustice. And I'm curious, like, what you found there. And what it's, how you would describe its character. How does injustice fester? What's the shape of it?
Yeah. One of the kind of interesting things is how shocking violence is and injustice is and was to me. Huh. But as someone who'd been reading their Bible their whole life, like, it's from the beginning to the end of the Bible. It begins with the murder of Cain, of Abel by Cain, and ends with the crucifixion, right? And then so there's just violent, sinful abuse. And so that's the thing that continues to be shocking but not surprising is that, and what the Bible teaches and what I've seen manifest is this idea of the flesh, the world, and the devil. As I say, the flesh, our fallen nature, man, And this was the thing that genocide investigations will show you, is that, oh, this is not like some special team of bad guys who go do this. The average human being, and every genocide manifests this, can very easily become a mass murderer, so much easier than you imagined. The fall of man is actually not going well. Like, if humans reject the God of all justice and goodness and love, this will go unbelievably bad. So there is that capacity within every nature. The world has systems of then structured abuse and violence. And there are spiritual forces of evil who will actually, at least the way I've seen this manifest, if you give yourself over to an evil force, it will take you down a road where you will actually, humans can have a capacity to enjoy violence and abuse, to exalt in it. On the other hand, Christ really does have a overwhelming project of redeeming this broken world, both in our fallen nature, both in the world and the spiritual forces. So we're on the winning side.
But so, you know, so this question gets raised regarding IJM's work, which is, you know, it's obviously excellent, obviously having an impact, but, you know, might the faith hiring practices limit the talent pool? Might the fact that staff stops to pray mean that you're less efficient? Sort of all of these, yeah, clearly the proof is in the pudding, the work is being done, but maybe you're being held back. Maybe there are some, and so I'd just love for you to speak a bit about, like, why was it important to you to create something that had a Christian, not just an identity, but is that informs the work and the life of the organization? And did you have the sense at the outset that this was going to be important? Was it only like, well, I'm a Christian, I want to create a Christian organization, and then you just sort of like learn? What was that about?
Yeah, well, the advantage of like starting your own club is you get to decide what kind of club you're going to have. And I had had two experiences of doing work trying to address violent abuse, human rights abuses, and so forth. One was in South Africa with a community of prayer, and also doing it with the UN or other institutions where that was just not part of the thing. It's like, well, I've had both experiences. I would like to do this in a community of prayer. And so that's just the way we started, and that's the way that we've grown. Because I needed that. If others can do it without that, fantastic, but I needed that. And that is my actual conviction, and that's our conviction at IJM, that the power to do the work of justice in the world comes from God. You don't need to acknowledge him for that power to be coming to you, but we think the power to that comes from the God of justice. We also believe the power to be the kind of person you'd like to be while doing the work of justice comes from God. So really, spending a half hour answering more emails or responding to more things, is that going to advance justice in the world or drawing closer to the God of justice for a half hour? And the likelihood of being able to actually be effective in the world seeking justice and seeking a disposition or a capacity for courage, for patience, for sacrifice and joy. If I can regain that by staying close to God, my sense is this will help us not only be more, well, of course, help us to be more effective, because that's where the power to do this actually comes from. Yeah.
Well, we have a friend and someone you've worked with a long time, Bethany, who wrote about deepening the soul for justice.
Yeah.
And it seems like we work with young professionals through our organization. And I think DC is just a story of people who come here with the greatest intentions, with their heart on fire for justice, for some sense of vision for the world. But if they don't have a well to draw from, burnout can come to even the most on fire, the most passionate. And so that has been, and as I've talked with IJM staff, sort of that sustaining nature in what can be not the most exciting work all of the time. I've heard you speak quite often the work like it looks like waiting outside a courthouse for for hours. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm trying to remember who wrote the song. The Book of Love is long and boring. Peter Gabriel. I think he's redoing, he's covering someone else wrote it, but this lovely song called The Book of Love is long and boring. The work of justice is long and boring, it turns out. So what is going to equip you to do long and boring work for a long time is really what the work of justice is about. And I think the tediousness, the heartache, the difficulty, we need spiritual resources, I think, to take those struggles on for a long time. Every great fight for justice, I think, that we would admire and draw strength and inspiration from, if you get into the history of it, wow, that was a long fight. Wow, that had no accompanying soundtrack to it that was beautiful. It was a difficult, hard road, and who we are inside by the grace of God is, I think, the thing that's going to turn out to be most essential. Yeah.
It's a closing question.
Yeah.
As you look out to the future, not just of IJM, but sort of the justice movement, like, what is the future of the movement for justice? Like, what is sort of the shining opportunity you see in the next decade to advance justice in this time?
I think the future of the movement of justice is really quite clear. It's prolonged suffering and deep heartache, followed by total triumph and worship of the Lamb upon the throne. That's the future of the movement for justice. I think the most shining opportunities for the followers of Jesus are engagement in the struggle for justice with joy. I think what the world most desperately needs, it just feels like, in a time of such anxiety and sadness, the world seems very, very full of anxiety and sadness, is for Christians to manifest a surprising freedom from fear and an incandescent joy. And if they were manifesting that while they were seeking justice and freedom for others, that would be something that would be hard to explain apart from the Lamb upon the throne. So there will be what it has to do with, like, issues and moments and places and geographies. I think there are just so many opportunities for that. But I do think it is the way, Jesus' way of doing that work, that will be actually the greatest witness in the world.
What a blessing it would be. Thank you, Gary.
Thanks, Michael. Thank you all. Thanks.
You've been listening to the For the Good of the Public podcast, an initiative of the Center for Christianity and Public Life. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review this podcast so you don't miss an episode. CCPL is a donor-supported nonprofit. Visit our website at ccpubliclife.org to learn how you can partner with us, and connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Our hosts for today's episode are CCPL founder and CEO Michael Ware, and myself, Chief of Staff and Senior Advisor Phoebe Meyer. Our podcast is produced by Glowfire Creative and Liminal Podcasts. Our in-studio recording engineer is Conrad Ossie Poets. Our podcast editor is Seth Creekmore. And our theme music is Lamb's Farm by Sam Barsh.